We are in the book of 2 Samuel. We're supposed to start with chapter 14, but Joyce said that was not right. It's chapter 15. And since Joyce is always the one that's right, and Don is always the one that's wrong, we're going to chapter 15. Actually, Joyce was right, Don was wrong. We're supposed to be in 15. For some reason, Don slept through 14 last week and was not aware that we had gone through 14. 15, 16, and 17, we'll try to get through tonight. And then Tom Steed will be your teacher next Wednesday night. I'll be at the Fried Hardeman Lectures and covet your prayers for that. I'll be speaking there next Thursday, morning. And so Tom will be your teacher for next week on chapter 18, 19, and 20, I believe it is, that he will be covering. So we'll start tonight with chapter 15. This is going to be a study in politics. This is going to be a study in human nature. This is going to be a study in a lot of different things with regard to how we are with people and the things that we try to do in order to impact people and to persuade people. There's a lot of different things that are going to take place in this. So, just kind of by way of review, let's just talk about it for a second. It's obvious when we come to this chapter, chapter 15, there's no more love on the part of Absalom for his father anymore. He's ready, Absalom is, to absolutely destroy his dad. And that's what he's going to do, or at least what he's going to attempt to do, what he's going to try to do. And he will not stop at anything in order to get that accomplished, in order to get there. What's happened that has led to this hatred on the part of Absalom toward his dad? There'd be a lot of things, but what are some of them? Not yet. Not yet. Solomon, not sure how old he is, but he's not chosen as a king until David gets ready to die, and that's not yet. That's not near the point of his death. He'll most likely be the one. How about a lot of it being projecting hatred towards somebody else? You've killed your brother. You thought he deserved it. But you've killed your brother. It has to weigh heavy on you. And you don't want to be the one to accept full responsibility for that, so you project it onto somebody else. That could be a part of it. And he could project this onto David, blaming David as much as he blames his brother for what happened to his sister. Because after all, when David hears about it, what does he do? He becomes angry, but that's it. But what would he do? You know, that woman from Tekoa who came in and told that story, that had an impact on David. That's what caused him to go bring Absalom back. Because what she's saying is right. There's anger because of what one brother has done to the other brother. But after a while, the grieving diminishes. And the longing to restore a relationship with the other son becomes strong. And you realize you can't bring the first one back. And so there is this move away from the anger and this move toward forgiveness. And we understand God a lot in that. And so that could be a part of what's going on. Although David is pretty slow about that forgiveness. Yeah, you bring him back, but he stays at his house. He's not seeing my face. And that doesn't change until Joab has his field burned down. And all of that is what's been taking place. And there's this anger and this resentment. And the birth of Solomon may have a part to do with it. Perhaps Absalom realizes, I'm never going to be king. My dad is never going to anoint me as king. Too much baggage. Too much things that have gone wrong. So here he goes in chapter 15. And Absalom has a plan. And he begins to devise that plan. I like this first part of it. Absalom, no doubt, didn't have any trouble taking care of himself financially. But the way the NIV reads it is that he provided for himself a chariot and horses in order to ride in. That means he went out and bought himself a vehicle. He went out and bought himself a carriage that has a horse to draw it. And so he has a chariot and a horse to be able to ride around with. And he also has with him 50 men who run ahead of him. There's bodyguards. And they run ahead of him in that chariot, and they go with him wherever he goes. And this was his habit. He'd get up early in the morning, and he'd go to the city of Jerusalem. And he'd stand on the side of the road next to the gate that enters into the city. And there he would stand, and whenever anybody would walk by, he would say, hey, where are you from? And typically they would say, we're from one of the cities of Israel. And then it kind of skips to what he would say to them, but the skip doesn't make sense. I think we have to add to it what's going on. They are coming to see the king, because the king is the judge, and they are coming to see the king because they have a quarrel. It may be a quarrel against another individual. It may be a quarrel against the government. Some ruling that the king may have made, but they have a quarrel and they're taking it to the highest authority, and there's no telling how many steps they've already made, but now they're coming to the king. And when Absalom would inquire as to what are you here for, they would tell him. And I guess, no doubt, they would tell him specifics about what it was they were wanting to talk to the king about. And Absalom would say, well, I got bad news for you. There's not anybody in the king's palace that's going to pay any attention to what you're saying. But only if I were the judge, if I were the judge and I could be elected judge, then I would see to it you got justice. With strong implication being, I would see to it that things went your way. And not only would he do that, but if anybody ever happened to recognize that this is Absalom, he is now the oldest surviving son of the king. And now, because this is Absalom and they recognize him, they would come up to Absalom and bow down to him. And Absalom, to every one of them that did that, would go over to them and take them by the arm and lift them up and give them a big hug and a big kiss. And they ate that up. And so the Bible tells us that with all of this, what did Absalom do? Stole the hearts of the people. He stole their hearts. We would say he's a good what? Politician. Actually, it goes both sides. It goes both ways. But it's not politicians, is it? Whenever you want to win somebody's friendship, but really, what is he interested in? He's not interested in winning friendship for him. What's he interested in doing? Yeah. Well, being the king, but what's he interested in happening to David? It doesn't really matter to Absalom if these folks like him or not. He just wants them to start hating David. And isn't that the way it is? When we have a jealousy and an envy and we don't want individuals to think well of other people. It doesn't really matter what you think about them, just as long as they can change your mind about the other one. And so what they try to do is to destroy what affection you have toward other people. And that's what Absalom is doing. He could care less about these individuals' cases. And he is in any position to make a judgment with regard to their cases. And his judgment wouldn't matter at all because he knows he's never going to do it. And he's not really interested in running for office because he's already got a plan in mind about what he's going to do to take the office. But he's got to change some hearts. He's got to get some individuals who think better of him than they think of David. And whether that means that they begin to like him, or if he can just say something to cause the others to dislike him, it doesn't matter to him. And so often that's the way it is in relationships. That's why the Bible condemns so much gossip and talking about other people and trying to point out the bad in others to people because of this very thing. God knows what we're doing. He knows why we're doing it. He knows exactly what we're doing. And we do too. We know why we say the things we say. It's because we want to change your affection toward those people. Even if you never like us, just don't like them anymore. And so often that's what happens. And that's what's going on here. This next verse, it's in verse 7. I have a footnote that does a pretty good job of explaining it. If you've got the NIV, you may have that same footnote as well. If you have a different translation, or one of the older ones, if you have a King James, New King James, American Standard Version, and I'm not sure which other ones there are. Verse 7 will say, at the end of 4 years. Anybody have a different reading? 40 years. At the end of 40 years. The Septuagint, or the Greek translations, and Josephus put 4. The Hebrew text puts 40. But most everybody realizes that somewhere along the line, a scribe missed the mark of a letter and put 40. Because 40 doesn't make any sense. Why does it not make any sense? Huh? Absalom may have been about that old, but 40 years from this date, where's David? He's dead. Who's king? Solomon. Or very close to it. And so this 40 years doesn't make sense. And they feel like that there's just that in the Hebrew text that we have somewhere along the line, a scribe made a mark that indicated 40 instead of 4. 40 years, that really doesn't make sense for what's going on and for how long he would do it. 4 years to me sounds pretty long. You wonder, has David heard about this yet at the end of 4 years? At the end of 4 years, does David realize what's going on and what's happening right outside the city walls? And this is taking place almost on a daily basis by his son Absalom. And in these 4 years, there's a lot of movement. In these 4 years, there's a lot of things that take place. So Absalom, at the end of the 4 years, comes into his dad and he says, "Let me go to Hebron." All right, right here's Jerusalem. Right here's Hebron. What do you remember about Hebron? What is significant about that city in connection with David? Huh? It's where you lived for a while. And what else happened there? That's where he was first anointed king. And so Hebron is the place where Absalom wants to go. And the reason he tells his dad that he wants to go there is when he was up here, when he went back to his grandfather's place, when he ran away from David after he had killed Amnon. Not Amnon. After he killed his brother. No, it is Amnon. Amnon had a friend named Jonadab, but Amnon. When he killed Amnon, he ran back to where his grandfather lived up here. And now he's back in Jerusalem. And now he tells David, "I want to go to Hebron because I made an oath to God. And the oath I made to God was that if God would ever allow me to come back to Jerusalem, I would go to Hebron and worship him." That's not why he's going to Hebron. That's what he's saying. And that's the oath that he tells David that he made. When David hears that this is the oath that he made and what his son is wanting to do, then he tells him, "We'll go to Hebron." So he does. When he goes to Hebron, he sends secret messages to all the tribes. And he tells all the tribes, "As soon as you hear the trumpets sound," and they would reverberate, and they would be signals passing from one station to another until they covered the entire nation of Israel. "And when you hear the trumpet sounds, then know that Absalom is king in Hebron." He's been anointed as king in Hebron, the very place where his dad was anointed as king. 200 men go with Absalom to Hebron. But those 200 men that he asked to go with him, they go with him there, but they have no idea why they're going. They have no idea what he's about to do. And the Bible lets us know they're completely innocent of the whole matter. They're not going there to anoint Absalom as king. They have no reason to remove David from being the king. But Absalom encourages these 200 to go with him anyway. And while he's there, he's offering sacrifices. There's a man that he sends for, and he's going to become important for us. His name is Ahithophel. And Ahithophel has been a longtime counselor and advisor, not counselor in the sense of a psychiatrist, but an advisor in the sense of, "Well, here's what I'm thinking about doing, this or this or this. What's your advice?" And that's who Ahithophel was to David and had been for some time. We're going to have a little bit more to say about him as we get into the next chapter because he's going to become very significant. And Ahithophel is asked by Absalom to join him, and he does. He does join Absalom, and evidently he knows exactly what's going on and exactly what's going to occur. And with Ahithophel becoming his advisor, the Bible tells us that this conspiracy begins to take hold. It begins to include a lot of people. It begins to become quite popular, to the point that it is going to be overwhelming. So overwhelming that it's going to lead us into the second part of this chapter. Can you imagine this? Of course you can. We're about to have a presidential election. If you listen to all the polls, where are we? Well, no matter who's running on the Democrat side, and if it's the case that Donald Trump is the only one on the Republican side, if you listen to all the polls, the latest ones even, it's a dead even split. Well, this is a little more than the polls that we have. But you would think, from everything that's been said about David and all that we know about David, everybody in Israel is happy with him being king. And now we know they're not. There are people all over Israel who would be happy to see David replaced. There are people all over Israel who would be happy if he was no longer the king and if Absalom, his son, became the king. Especially those who talked face to face with Absalom and heard the promises Absalom made to each and every individual. May very well be that everybody that talked to Absalom has the idea, every problem I've got is going to be solved if Absalom becomes king. And my problems aren't being solved by David, but every problem I've got is going to be solved if Absalom becomes king. That may very well have been, that's the way it was. Or it just may be the new thing on the block, and we got the new kid on the block, and why not change? Why not have a change? And so this thing takes momentum. And the momentum for it becomes very strong. So much so that a messenger in verse 15 comes to David and tells him, the hearts of the people of Israel are with Absalom. They're no longer with you, David. The hearts of the people of Israel are now with Absalom. And when David heard that, he immediately said, we have to get out of Jerusalem. If we don't leave Jerusalem, we won't survive. So we have to get out of Jerusalem. So they immediately begin the process of leaving. He gathered together all of his officials who were with him, and he told them, we've got to flee. We've got to leave immediately. And if we don't move quick, he's going to overtake us and overthrow us. So all the king's officials says to him, we're with you. We'll do whatever you want to do. We'll do and go wherever you want to go. So the king set out. And he left 10 concubines, 10 of his wives. Not important wives, not the ones officially recognized as wives, but he left 10 of his wives, 10 concubines, to be left behind at the palace to take care of the palace. Y'all may have a hard time with that, and I guess I did until my first visit to Sierra Leone, and you understand in Sierra Leone and other places in Africa, there's polygamy, there's plural marriages. And the first time I ran into this, a man will marry the wife he can afford. And when he marries the woman he can afford, he already has his mind and his heart set on someone else, but he can't afford someone else. And so he marries the woman he can afford and puts her to work to earn him the money that he needs in order to buy the wife that he wants. And that becomes the head wife, chief wife. And it may be something similar, but it's not that way with David, though, because his wives were more of a political in nature than anything else. And doesn't mean he doesn't love them, but they also gained him friends in other countries and in other territories. And that could be one of the reasons why his love for Jonathan was greater than his love for women. Jonathan was a true friend. I may be reading too much into that, but that's at least part of it. So he left 10 concubines behind to take care of the palace. And so the king set out with all the people following. All his men marched past him. He stopped and watched. And as he's watching and he sees all of these men passing by him, he's crying. All the people passing by are crying because of what's happened and because of what's happening. The three groups of people, the Kerethites, the Pelethites, and then there are 600 men who are Gittites. The Kerethites and Pelethites seem to have come from the area of the Aegean Sea up north. And what they are mercenaries who have been connected with David for some time. There are some that believe that all three of these groups are connected with the Philistines, or the Philistines, ever how you want to say it. We know the Gittites are because the Gittites are a group from Gath. And Gath is a city in the Philistine territory where David spent some time. And he has a friend of his who has 600 men who evidently from this account have just come to join forces with David. Because they like David, they want to be a part of his kingdom, they want to be a part of his army. These are not Israelites, but these are three different groups of people who have joined themselves to David, and they stay with him for a long time. They stay with him right up until the days of Solomon. After the days of Solomon, they're not mentioned anymore. But they are the ones who fight with David in his battles throughout his life, and they're the ones who helped Solomon establish his kingdom, and then they kind of disappear from the table. One of the reasons, probably, because the wars were fought in the days of David. In the days of Solomon, it was times of peace, and there were no wars fought. And so the mercenaries had nothing else to do. And once they had the kingdom established for Solomon. And so these men are there, and David the king makes an interesting statement about the Gittites. And he especially talks to the leader. And he said to him, "You don't need to stay here. You're a foreigner. This isn't your home. This isn't your country. And there's nothing here for you. There's no reason for you to go with me while I'm fleeing and have no idea where I'm going to be or what I'm going to be doing. You go back home." And Gittite said to David, "Wherever you go, we're going to go. Wherever you stay, we're going to stay. And if you going where you're going means your death, when we die with you. But we're not going back." And they pledged themselves to David. And so David says to them, as he says to the others, "Then march on. Then let's go." And so they begin to go, and they make their way. In verse 22, this is when David tells him to march on. Verse 23 talks about everybody weeping and crying as they cross the Kidron Valley. Now remember the Kidron Valley. Kidron Valley is that little valley that runs down by the wall in Jerusalem. And they begin to make their way up the Mount of Olives. And they make their way up to the Mount of Olives until they get to the summit. And the summit is the top of the Mount of Olives. If you've ever seen pictures of Jerusalem and all, then you know that that's where they are. While they're beginning to make this trip, they haven't gone up the Mount of Olives yet. They are in the Kidron Valley, just outside the wall. They're making their way toward the Mount of Olives. And the priest, Zadok, comes. He comes along with the other priest, Abiathar, and they have the ark. And while the people come marching by as they're leaving the city of Jerusalem, they set the ark down and they offer sacrifices for the safety of all the people. David comes by and he sees the priest and he sees the ark and he tells the priest, take the ark back. Because if God wants me to come back, I'll see the ark when I get back. I'll see it again, and I'll see his tabernacle again. But if God has other plans for me, and if God does not intend for me to come back, the ark's not going. And so they agree, and they take the ark back. But he has a plan for them. I want you guys to go back, you two priests, and I want you to take your two sons, and I want your two sons to be messengers. That whatever you hear is going on with Absalom, I want you to send them and tell me. And there's a very interesting thing that's going to become important in the next chapter or two. And that is that David says, where David is going, he's coming out of Jerusalem. He's going to cross the Jordan River right in here where there are fords, shallow places. And he's going to eventually make his way up to this city. But what he's telling them is, I'm going to come to these fords and I'm going to stop. And I'm going to stay there at those fords and I'm not going to cross the Jordan until you send me word as to what's happening with Absalom and what Absalom's plans are. And that's what he tells the priest. And the reason why he has their sons appointed as individuals that will bring him messages. So now David begins to climb the Mount of Olives. He comes to the summit. And when he gets to the summit, he has already heard that Ahithophel is now the counselor for Absalom. And when he hears that, when he gets to the top of the summit, there's a man that we're introduced to by the name of Hushai, the Archite. He's torn his clothes, has dust all over him because he's been in mourning because of what's happening. And he's standing at the summit waiting for David to come. And when David comes, he said, if you go with me, you'll be a bother for me. I don't know what he means by that, unless it means it would be somebody David would worry about or be concerned about. But what he does is he tells him this, what I want you to do is I want you to go into Jerusalem and wait for Absalom, and when he comes, I want you to swear your oath to Absalom. And the reason I want you to swear your oath to Absalom is so that whatever Ahithophel advises him to do, you can change his advice towards something else and have his advice to become wrong. As soon as David heard that Ahithophel was now the advisor to Absalom, he prayed to God, God, make his advice, Ahithophel's advice, turn into foolishness. And his way of accomplishing that was to have this man to go and to swear his oath of allegiance to Absalom. And this is what he's asked him to do. So Hushai, David's confidant, goes back to Jerusalem, and he gets there at the same time that Absalom is entering the city. There's a man that's walking along. We're introduced to, not yet, verse 16. When David had gone to the summit and he was up at the top of the Mount of Olives, Ziba came. You remember Ziba? He's the guy that was a servant of Saul who's supposed to be taking care of all of Mephibosheth's stuff. You remember Mephibosheth is the lame son of Jonathan. And David has given Mephibosheth all of the land that belonged to Saul. And Ziba has come, and he's got these donkeys that are loaded with food. He's got all kinds of food and wine, and got these donkeys loaded with him, with them. And David says, "What's all this?" He says, "All of this is the food for you and your journey. And the wine is for anybody who becomes thirsty and weary on the way. And all of this is supplied to you so that you can have a safe journey and have the supplies that you need for your journey." And David says, "Where's Mephibosheth?" And Ziba says, "I tried to get him to come, but he's refusing to leave the palace. Because he says that the people will restore the kingdom to him because he's the son of Saul. Therefore, he's staying behind so that the kingdom can become his instead of it being your kingdom." David says to Ziba, "All the land that belonged to Mephibosheth is now yours." And Ziba blesses David and thanks him mightily. You're going to run into him next week. Ask yourself, do you think he's lying? Or do you think he's telling the truth? I'll jump ahead a little bit for next week, but I'm not very far, just to make one statement. David doesn't know. He has both of them. He talks to both of them. He doesn't know who's lying and who's telling the truth. And so he has a way of solving the problem. And you'll see that in you. Familiar with the passage, the text, you already know what it is. So, after Ziba, then David starts the journey again. And this time we're introduced to a guy by the name of Shimei. He's of the tribe of Benjamin. He's never been happy with David being the king. He thought the kingdom belonged to Saul. And he wanted somebody from Saul's family to be the king. He would be one of the ones who never has been happy with David being king. And now that David is no longer, or rather now that David is being driven out of the city of Jerusalem by his own son Absalom, he is walking along on the top of the hill up above David, and he is cursing him every step of the way. What is cursing? It's not profanity. Not here. It's calling down what you wish would happen to somebody. It's calling down on them what you hope would happen to them. What you're predicting is going to happen to them. And none of it is favorable. When the children of Israel crossed over into the promised land, by God's command, they were to divide the entire nation into two groups. And they were to stand on top or on the sides of two mountains that were situated very close to each other. And half of the people on one mountain were to call out the blessing. Those on the other mountain were to call out the curses. It's not profanity. The blessings were all the things that are going to happen to you if you obey the law. The curses were all the things that are going to happen to you if you disobey the law. And God had the children of Israel to pronounce blessings and cursings in the hearing of all of them so that they would know. Here are the positive things, the good things that are going to happen if you pay attention to God's law. Here are the bad things. And so now here's this Shimei, and he's calling down curses on top of David, telling him that what's happening to him is what he deserves. He never should have been king. You are running from your son just like you ought to, and calling him probably all kinds of names like coward, dog, and saying all these different things to him, just demeaning him, telling him that he's getting everything that he deserves. In addition to that, he's up on top of David. He's above him walking on the side of the hill, and he's just raking down dirt and stones on top of David, covering everybody below him with rocks and with dirt, just doing everything that he can to shame David. And one of the men of David says, "Let me go cut his head off." And David says, "How do you know it's not God telling him to do that? How do you know that he's not saying exactly what God told him to say? My own son is taking over the kingdom and desires to kill me. What do you think this man, by his words, is doing to me? Nothing compared to what my son is doing to me and to what God's already doing to me. We will leave him alone. We will not do him any harm." We come back to this guy later on in another place in the Bible. And so David has him protected, has him left alone, and David and his men continue on the journey. Absalom and his men come to the palace. We're going to have to hustle. When they come to the palace, Absalom comes in, and David's man comes up to David. And he says to David, "Long live the king. Long live the king." And Absalom says, "What are you doing? Why aren't you with David? Your loyalty is to David." And Hushai says to him, "No, my loyalty is to the man the Lord chooses to be the king. My loyalty is to the man the people of Israel choose to be the king. As my loyalty was with David when he was the king, now my loyalty is with you because you're the king. And I will serve you as I served your father David." So Absalom says, "Okay then, stay with me." But he turns to his first advisor. And when he turns to his first advisor, he says to Ahithophel, "What should I do?" The Bible inserts it in this chapter. I'm not sure if it's exactly in this context or if it's in the next one. But it says that during the days of David, the words of Ahithophel were like the words of God. So good was his advice and so strong was his advice that it was not dismissed by David. And Absalom feels the same way about him. He's that much of an intelligent man who sees and is aware of what's going on around him. So when Absalom says to him, "What should I do?" he says to him, "Take those 10 concubines that your father left behind. Go up onto the roof with them and set up tents and set up lights, so that all of Jerusalem can see what's happening on the roof of the palace. And then you go in to each and every one of those concubines and you sleep with them. Because when the people of Jerusalem see you doing that, they will know that you have become detestable in the sight of your father. And when they see that you are detestable in the sight of your father, then they will be invigorated to stand opposed to your father and to stand for you. And Absalom says, that's what we'll do. And that's what he does. In fulfillment of a prophecy God made to whom? David. In connection with David's sin with Bathsheba, where God said, you did this privately, but I'm going to take someone close to you and they will do the same thing publicly. So this is exactly what God was talking about that was going to occur because of David's sin with Bathsheba. So he does that. And then verse 23 is where it talks about the respect that Ahithophel had in the eyes of David and also in the eyes of Absalom. So chapter 17, Ahithophel's next question is this: what do we do? And Ahithophel said, give me 2,000 men. I believe that number's right. Isn't that right? Is it 2,000? Huh? 1,200 men? 12,000. Why does he need that many? Yeah, 12,000. That's right. Boy, I miss. Okay. Give me 12,000 men. You can whip a lot of people with 12,000 people. Give me 12,000 people, and we'll go after David because he's going to be tired. He and everybody with him is going to be tired. And he won't go very far, and he'll camp with everybody else. By the way, what did David tell his priest he was going to do? Where's he going to wait? At the fords. Is he going to cross the Jordan River? No. He's doing exactly what this advisor is saying David's going to do. And David's already told the priest that's exactly what he's going to do. And so this advisor, Ahithophel, says he'll be sleeping with everybody else. He won't cross the river. They'll rest. They'll be worn out. They'll be tired. Give me 12,000 men and we'll go after them. And here's what we will do. We will go and we will kill only David. And once we have killed David, the rest of the army will come back to Jerusalem with us and follow you. All we need to do is just to kill David. And it will turn the rest of the army around. Now granted, there may be some like Joab. There may be some of David's mighty men who would fight, but it wouldn't be the entire army. And with that 1,200 men, or 12,000 men, he would be able to defeat David and the ones that would fight with him, and they would come back. And everybody, when they heard Ahithophel say that, they said, that sounds great. That's exactly what we need to do. Absalom said, let's hear from the new guy first. And when he turned to the new guy, and I always have a hard time pronouncing his name, so I have to go back to it. I'm getting one of those. My phone's not with me. It's in yonder, but it's ringing on my watch. So I apologize for that, but it's one of those calls you, nobody ever wants to answer. But anyway, when he turned to the other advisor, he didn't really turn to him. He turned to his people. And he said, let's hear what Ahitar has to say. Let's hear what the other advisor has to say. So they called him in and they told him what Ahithophel had said. And they said, what's your advice? And he said, well, this time Ahithophel's advice is not good. And the reason it's not good is because David and his men are mighty warriors. And David is smart. And already he's not with everybody else. Everybody else will be together, but he's already hidden somewhere in a cave. And he will have crossed over where he would be protected. And if you go, you will not find David. And then Absalom's army will suffer a defeat. And if Absalom's army suffers a defeat, then what will happen is the word will get out to all of Israel that Absalom's army has already been whipped. And then everybody will turn against you and you will not be able to establish your kingdom. And Absalom thought about that. And he said, that's right. And so that counselor went on and said, what you need to do is wait. Send messages out to all of the nation of Israel and raise your army until it's like the sands of the seashore. And when you have that vast army built, then go and battle against David and we'll defeat them completely and soundly. And Absalom says, that's what we're going to do. So, this advisor, knowing the plan and what's set up to get word to David, sends a message to the sons priest's sons, and says to them, here's what Absalom was told to do. You need to get David to move. You need to get David to cross the Jordan and to get on up to the city that he's going to. So the two messengers left to come, but they were seen. They knew they were seen. And so they go to a man's house, and he has a well out in his front yard. And they go into the well, and the woman of the house puts a cover over the well and then sprinkles grain all over it. And so when the soldiers come, or the people come that are looking for those two messengers, they say, have they been here? And she says, yes, they have, but they've already left across the brook. And they go pursue them, but they don't ever find them. And the guys hide in the well until those guys are gone. And then they get up and they make their way to where David is at the Jordan River. And they tell David what Absalom's plans are. And everybody immediately gets up and they cross the Jordan River and they go to the place where they can hide from Absalom. And Absalom raises his army and they all come after David. And they all come after David in order to destroy him. David, it says in verse 24, went to Mahanaim. Absalom crossed the Jordan with all of his men, and Absalom appointed Amasa over the army in place of Joab. This is interesting. This is in verse 25 and 26. Amasa was the son of Jether, an Ishmaelite. Not an Israelite, but from Abraham's other son, Ishmael. He was an Ishmaelite who had married Abigail. And Abigail was the daughter of Nahash, who was the sister of Zariah, who was the mother of Joab. So now Absalom has picked the man to lead his army, a guy who by marriage is related to Joab, the leader of David's army. Even though he's not an Israelite, he's from another place. This family, they know all these people. They know each other. So Absalom and all his men camped in the land of Gilead. And David came to Mahanaim. And then there were three individuals from northern territories that came and joined him. They came and joined him and they brought him food. They brought him all that he would need in order to eat and to live. And the people who came were exhausted and hungry and thirsty in the wilderness, and they had food to eat, and they were taken care of. David had a lot of friends. He had a lot of friends from different countries and different places, and they all joined in to help him in this battle that he was soon to have with his son Absalom. So that's where you'll pick up next week. Don, we are going to be next week ready for chapter 18. And Tom will be your teacher at that time, and I know you'll enjoy the class. Thank y'all. Have a good night. Have a good week.